This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
The dirt behind denial.
Social barriers against climate action. Neuropsychologist Adam Aron investigates with his book, The Climate Crisis.
From Grist, senior writer Naveen Asadasivam breaks stories of state repression, corporate wrongdoing, and outright corruption to grease the deadly status quo.
Nobody thinks climate misinformation is accidental.
Imagine an expert studying psychology in the brain wakes up to discover climate disaster threatens everything. Does she or he drop everything to look for climate solutions? At the University of California, San Diego, Professor Adam Aron sort of did. As a recognized expert in cognitive neuropsychology, he began teaching undergrad courses called Psychology of the Climate Crisis. Then he put it all in an accessible textbook, The Climate Crisis, published by Cambridge University Press in 2023. What can we learn about how minds, hearts, and lives change? From San Diego, California, Adam Aron, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks very much, Alex. Glad to be here.
Just to warm up, what is a neuropsychologist? What did you study?
So there's different kinds of psychologists, but the neuropsychologist is the kind of psychologist who tries to understand how the mind works by also bringing the brain into the equation. So I did experiments, sat people down in front of computers, measured how they move, how they decide how to move, how they stop moving, and while doing so, measured their brain in various sorts of ways.
A few years ago, world-recognized sustainability expert Jem Bendel dropped out of his field. He said none of it was sustainable. Recently, you talked with Allison Green, another successful academic who left to become an activist. She's now director of the group Scientists Warning. Adam, why did you make the big change in your career?
I understood about I wouldn't call it the climate crisis back then, but I knew that there was global heating probably for about 20 years. I remember being a PhD student and getting the memo and being concerned about it. But I was so busy doing my career and being a parent and distracted by other things. And it's really around about 2016 that I sort of had the space to get involved, and I got involved in the fossil fuel divestment movement at the UC system. But I don't think I really was even an activist at that point. I didn't really understand how serious this was until I got my eyes on the IPCC 2018 report, the so-called 1.5 Celsius report. Now, that was a turning point, I think, for many people. I took a little bit of time to look at that because I was preparing a class, and it's really when I got my own eyes on the scientific data and really understood the seriousness of the predicament that I just became really alarmed, and I felt like I'm in a position of privilege here. I'm a tenured professor. I have the bandwidth. I have the time. I have the capacity to dedicate more of my time to the climate crisis. And it sort of went bit by bit as I started teaching, and then I was an activist and organizing in the University of California. And I just started spending more and more of my time on this to the point where I just felt I have to just stop doing neuroscience altogether and dedicate myself to it. So that's how it happened.
Many of us hope this generation of students can respond to climate challenges where their parents failed. You taught a course, Psychology of the Climate Crisis. What did you learn from your students?
Well, my general view on this is we shouldn't be saying to students, you've got to deal with this, you've got to solve it. I think we older people need to do so too, and particularly we've benefited from it with our high carbon intensive lifestyle, so we need to be part of the equation too. But yeah, learning from the students, I think it's hard to generalize, but a lot of young people, for example, I think about undergrads in the University of California, even if they haven't taken my class or haven't even really taken any class about climate change that gets into depth, they understand and they intuit from the wider education they've had or from the media that we really have a problem here, and they feel, in general, if I can generalize, they feel deadened and helpless and hopeless, and it's something that they don't really want to think about very much because they don't know what to do. And so what I think learned by teaching the students, interacting with them, is that there's a way to present the climate predicament and the seriousness of it and the pace at which it's unfolding and the inadequacy of national and international action, and couple that very heavy message, sort of reality-based message, at the same time with a grounded kind of optimism, right? A sense of the power of social movements, how social change is made. And I think the magic bullet, I haven't really worked this out myself, but is to combine the the dread and the fear and the anxiety about this terribly, serious unfolding predicament with hopeful messages that are grounded in how social change is made. And I think when I do a good job at that, at times I find the eyes light up, and students jump in and get involved in all sorts of ways. So I think that's what I've learned. There's a combination that's important here in our communication and our teaching.
The book Climate Crisis tries to resolve questions frustrating to so many of us. Just as science enters a golden era of understanding how life in this planet works right out into the galaxies, humanity seems unable to get off a suicidal pathway. Did you manage to bring over tools from cognitive psychology to help us in the climate struggle?
Well, I didn't bring tools from neuroscience, that's for sure, although I did bring, I guess, my scientific training, which is helpful. But I am in a psychology department, and I am sort of closer to the field of social psychology and environmental psychology just by virtue of, the kinds of techniques and understanding I have. And so I suppose to some extent I've been able to delve into the wider literature, particularly of the social psychology of collective action and some of the psychology research that's been done on beliefs and attitudes. And definitely I've been able to incorporate some of that in how I teach and how I understand the issue and how to get bigger societal level mobilization, yes.
So many books and so much research tends to leave out Africa and climate impacts. In your book, you interview a climate activist from Mozambique. Why your personal interest, and what happens in Africa if we allow the world to warm 3 degrees C?
Yes, I originally grew up in southern Africa in a small country called Swaziland. And, it's sort of foremost in my mind. I mean, I was privileged there, a little white boy growing up in black Africa and going to an international school. But I was very mindful at the time, and I'm certainly very mindful now, that of those landscapes, of the large mammals, of those trees, of the local people who've done very little to incur any of this. They live with very little carbon intensity. They're not flying around in jet airplanes. And I can just intuit and actually start to see the impacts unfolding on them that they were not going to be able to adapt to and be resilient towards. And so that imbues me with a greater sense of responsibility. I'm in the climate struggle on behalf of a wider humanity that doesn't have the privilege I do. So that's part of my focus. And I think it's important to bring those African voices and voices from elsewhere in the global south into my teaching and book. And there's really not enough of that in my teaching and book, but I'd like to get more. Your question about the impacts on Africa, well, global heating is going to be felt unevenly. I mean, partly it's that the amount of heating is unequal. Parts of sub-Saharan Africa are slated to experience about double the heating of the global average. So that's one issue. And the other important issue is they are much more vulnerable in their agriculture and their way of living to climate change and the impacts. I mean, for example, they've experienced colossal cyclones, they call them, rather than hurricanes, hitting Mozambique and Malawi, devastating entire cities. And, in the United States, we just keep rebuilding, but they can't rebuild. So I'm alert to one of the senses or meanings of climate justice. It has many different meanings, but one of them is that the impacts of climate crisis are felt much more on some people than others, and it's particularly the vulnerable people who will get the greatest impacts and have done the least to incur the problem.
Over the years, I've seen maps projecting deserts developing in a wide band around the equator as the world heats. In this book, we find something new, at least it was to me. You provide a map showing the increase in regions becoming really too hot for humans. Places over 29 degrees C, mean average temperatures, go from a few spots in North Africa and the Middle East to some of the most heavily populated places on the planet, including in Pakistan and India, as early as 2070 on our current path. What would that mean? What would happen?
Well, that's the work of Tim Lenton and others, published in Prestigious National Academy of Sciences and a number of other journals. That is assuming what's called the RCP 8.5, in other words, the sort of worst pathway that the IPCC considers, where we keep on extracting and burning fossil fuels, which we seem to be right now. But, of course, we may get off that pathway. Things may not turn out as bad, depending on what we do. But if we stay on a very bad pathway and we incur tipping points and we escalate our emissions, then that doesn't seem unlikely that what is now just a few hot spots around the Sahara and Djibouti would basically expand to affect, the mean annual temperature would be like that in about, affecting about up to 3 billion people. So presumably what will happen is there'll be massive migration out of those areas, and it'll put orders of magnitude more pressure on Europe than we saw even from the Syrian war, and and pressure on the U.S. southern border. And so this is part, I think, of why the U.S. military and the Pentagon have called climate change the greatest threat they face. That seems to have fallen out of the news lately, but I think they're worried about global instability.
Well, this is one of the wild things for me in American politics. I mean, shouldn't conservatives be among the first to fight for emissions reduction so the tide of foreigners they fear so much does not become a reality?
That is a good idea. And that's part of what we call in our science communication co-benefits framing, right? If we consider conservative Americans or Republicans, to some extent they will support policy irrespective of beliefs about climate change. They don't have to change their minds about climate change to support good policy. And you see examples of that on jobs. You see examples of that on air pollution. And as you've rightly pointed out, I think another example is national security. I don't know how common that is, but that's a very good avenue of potential communication to get people to support policy just on those grounds alone.
Well, let's chat about what you cover in Chapter 4, Capitalism and the Climate. Do you think climate change and general destruction of nature are inherent to capitalism and its compulsion to always expand?
Yeah, I think it's connected. I think the expansionary compulsion is inherent to any form of capitalism, even the nicer forms, if you want to put it like that. And that's partly why we need to consider, what I refer to in that chapter as post-growth policy, sometimes called degrowth, which I think is a confusing term, but post-growth policies. We certainly can keep a capitalist system, but take some of the sting out of it by bringing in policies that, reduce consumption. So that's part of it.
And surveys show belief or disbelief in climate appears in clusters, partly according to economic beliefs like socialism or free market capitalism. Do we know why voting habits and belief in climate tend to line up? Does it tell us anything useful?
I think it does. It's tricky because in the United States, we just really have two parties, and so there's not a lot of space for nuance. And in countries where you have many more parties, people can kind of align themselves a bit differently. So someone could be conservative on economics, maybe, or conservative on social issues, but still be, fervently a believer in climate change. And here, it's all sort of wrapped up together. To put it simplistically, perhaps, I mean, the belief in the preeminence of the free market and not wanting government interference and believing in hierarchical organization and believing in individualism, all of those things sort of go together with each other. And those are beliefs that are strongly correlated with not believing in climate change or not believing in the human cause. And I think, there's a number of issues wrapped up there, but one of them is that climate change or the climate crisis is a rude awakening for people who can't countenance government intervention, and we're going to have serious policies. So if you're against government introducing policies, you're automatically going to have a strong bias not to believe in climate change.
I read on in your book to see if you, as a professor at a high-ranked American university, call for revolution for an end to capitalism. You do not. Why not?
Well, I'm not a revolutionary myself. I'm not a Marxist revolutionary in that sense. The way I'd answer that is just to say I would actually quote one of my intellectual heroes, no other than Noam Chomsky, who, or paraphrase him, his whole life has been, an ardent critic of capitalism, right? And so he wrote this interesting book, I think Global Climate Crisis and the Green New Deal, I think it's called, with the UMass economist Robert Polin. And, while starting out saying, we need to do what we can to make a better world, they made the very, I think, realistic and cogent point that in the time scale we have for climate stabilization, right, which, by the way, is probably the next 10 years, there really isn't time to countenance any kind of overthrow of capitalism. We need to be able to make the changes we can under state capitalist systems. And they go further and point out that those state capitalist systems are compatible with industrial policy and all kinds of levels of market interference and state subsidy and initiative, and have been so for years. And if you think back to the New Deal era, that's what it was. There was a capitalist system with substantive interference. World War II in the United States, a capitalist system. An emergency was declared. The public supported it. And they were rationing. You weren't allowed to drive cars for joyriding. All air conditions were requisitioned for the war effort. There was standardization of production. 22 million victory gardens were grown, and infant mortality went down and health outcomes went up, and people tolerated it. And if we think about the pandemic, I mean, the year 2020, over about an 18-month period, I think the federal government pumped about $4 trillion into the U.S. economy. People experiencing homelessness were housed in hotels up and down the land, and most of us were paid to stay at home. So we certainly can, under a capitalist system, see very significant state intervention, subsidies, and industrial policy. And I think to get climate stabilization, that's at least a necessary ingredient of what we have to do.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You are listening to neuropsychologist and climate activist Adam Aaron on Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We are talking about the mind in climate crisis and what we can do. Adam, under U.S. law, a corporation is a person with all the rights of a person. If ExxonMobil or Saudi Aramco are people, what would a psychologist say about them? What kind of people are they?
Yeah, they're psychopaths or sociopaths, I suppose. I mean, it's not so simple. Those companies and their executives have a fiduciary responsibility to maximize profits, right? And the rest of us are busy consuming a lot of the time. If we can't escape it, we don't have enough money to escape it right now. We're consuming their product. So they sort of integrate in our system. But, I mean, I think it's very important to recognize that their culpability and responsibility goes beyond just their role as maximizers of shareholders' profits, which is that from the 1970s and 80s, ExxonMobil and Shell very clearly understood that burning fossil fuels was going to produce global heating and devastating damage. We've got ample documents to prove that now. Actually, there were revelations yesterday about Shell Oil actually mapping out different scenarios. And even though they had that information back then, as did the U.S. government and U.S. government scientists in the 1970s and late 70s and early 80s, they deliberately chose a pathway of confusion, distortion, denial, fermenting, dissent, and they've carried on doing that to this day. It's taken on different guises. And it's because of that pattern of deliberately trying to confuse the public, greenwashing, and promoting misinformation that I think they are absolutely culpable. That's what makes them sociopaths and psychopaths, and you know, they need to be held accountable.
I totally agree. Climate misinformation is not accidental. Massive global fossil interests injected billions into plans and machinations designed to neuter public demand for real action. And some of their hired guns used psychology against the public interest, I think. So how would you introduce students who are not really aware of it yet to this denial machine, as you call it?
Well, I talk about that in my chapter 5. I have some parts about that. I mean, I suppose I would do it, you know, in two stages. I mean, first is to help students understand, you know, what was known, or maybe three stages. First, to understand what was known in the 1980s and sort of the history of Exxon New, as it were. Then to sort of carry that period from the mid-1980s to about 2010 or so, or maybe 2015 even, where there's this pattern of, you know, finding a few scientists who are going to speak out and make out that they're part of, you know, consensus, to undermine the scientific consensus, to cause doubt on the IPCC, to obfuscate and distort the science. And then that's what they did for that period. And then from about, I think it's about 2015 until now the strategy has shifted, right? So the fossil fuel companies don't anymore deny that climate change is real. They don't even deny that burning fossil fuels is causing it. If you look at the ads of ExxonMobil, now what they do is position themselves as part of the climate solution, right? So I'd have to educate students about the history and the pattern of that form of denial and distortion, but then the new form that the propaganda has taken. And this is very much about touting climate solutions such as so-called carbon capture from smokestacks and blended hydrogen and offsets and all sorts of stunts like that.
And then there's the funding for universities. You pass on a shocking list of name-brand energy institutes from MIT to Stanford and Berkeley that get money from Chevron and BP and Shell and other companies. And I wonder, too, about all the universities that haven't divested from fossil fuels. You've got billions and billions of dollars that's actually funding something that will damage the future of the students they teach. How does all this money shape knowledge, or does it?
I think it does shape knowledge. I mean, Noam Oreskes and Ben Franta and Jeffrey Supran and people like this have written very convincing articles and books, book-length studies of the ways in which corporate money universities, but fossil money in particular, distorts the agenda. There was an article by Amy Westerfeld in The Guardian a couple of weeks ago sort of adding up the something like $700 million of fossil fuel money to U.S. universities over the last decade or something like that. And certainly in the University of California where I am, it's something like $130 million over the last 5 years to fund scientists and academics, not only from the fossil fuel industry, but also from the investor-owned utilities. So there are concrete examples one can give of what seem to be conflicts of interest and all sorts of influence peddling and buying. And there's a memo from, I think it's ExxonMobil, or actually no, from the fossil fuel industry, I think 1998, that Ben Franter has uncovered, that details what they call their strategy of actually influencing academics. So I can't give you those quotes right now specifically, but there's multiple examples of where this has been shown.
You clearly explain in the book the intentional misinformation machine, but that's not enough to explain some of the resistance to climate science out there. Some individuals, without any links to big oil or gas money, they make it their lives' work to chop down climate scientists, to put down any hopes. Why do they do it?
I think it's ideological. That of course, in some ways, describes most of mainstream economics, what you've just said. Neoclassical economics, I mean, not every economist, but in general, the field has hardly paid any attention to climate change, something like 57 articles out of 77,000 as of 2019 in the mainstream journals covered climate change. And when they did, they tend to sort of dramatically underestimate the damages. So there's doctrinal, ideological resistance. I think if you are sort of an archetypal Cold War warrior, like some of the people in, you know, Naomi Klein's Merchants of Doubt book, then you know, people intuit that dealing seriously with climate change requires, you know, government intervention, and you're fundamentally against government intervention, then you have a way in there to start fighting it. I think it's on those grounds. I think Naomi Klein said, you know, climate change detonates the central beliefs of conservatism, right? The neoliberal form wants to shatter solidarity and make everything individual and privatized. Well, this problem was going to require absolutely large amounts of solidarity and all forms of regulation and government subsidy and government interference and good policies. And so it's a direct challenge to the fundamental ideology of neoliberal capitalism. I guess that's a simple way of putting it.
Can you give our listeners any tips on what to do and what not to do when confronted with someone strongly arguing against climate reality?
Well, I'm not so good on that on the fly myself. I tend to get hot under the collar. But I think there's a number of strategies I talk about in the book if I'm more cool-headed about it. There's different kinds of skepticism. The first I talk about is epistemic skepticism. In other words, people skeptical about the knowledge that there's a human cause, that the impacts are here. And there's response skepticism, right? People accept that climate change is a real thing, but they seem to want to deny that they have any role to play. So first of all, you have to sort of ask, you know, what kind of skeptic am I dealing with? And if you're dealing with the first kind, which is the epistemic skeptic, then there's a couple of techniques that can be used. One of them is called in-group messaging, right? So if you're dealing with evangelicals, then it's helpful to find an evangelical. You can say, you know, I'm like Catherine Hayhoe, professor. I'm an evangelical and I believe in climate change. And that's an incredibly powerful thing to do. People in the South, someone speaks to them with a Southern accent. So the sort of in-group messaging. The other thing is to recognize that when you talk with someone like, you know, your skeptical uncle in the California Central Valley or something like that, the things that people say about climate change being a hoax or the things they say about vaccines are what you could call the surface attitudes. And you seldom get anywhere by sort of confronting people on the surface attitudes with data and facts. But those surface attitudes reflect underlying attitude roots. And the attitude roots are their worldviews and ideologies, the conspiracy thinking, and the vested interests. Now, it's difficult to do this on the fly in conversation. I'm not very good at it. But if you start talking to someone who expresses epistemic skepticism about climate change, and you can actually start instead having a conversation with them about the underlying attitude roots, for example, their fears about government intervention, and you could talk about World War II or the COVID pandemic or examples of the New Deal, you might actually be able to shift people's beliefs on the underlying attitude route, and that may shift their surface attitude. So that's one kind of suggestion. And also, as I mentioned earlier, you know, the co-benefits framing, people who are skeptical about climate change can actually support policy even without changing their beliefs about climate change. So, for example, ranchers in Colorado wanted to take advantage of wind by installing turbines on their lands, and so they put pressure on the Republican governor of Colorado to bring a clean electricity standard, right? And so you can get good policy that actually gives you clean electricity without people actually changing their climate change beliefs.
You would think people whipped by repeated strong hurricanes or burned out by heat wave wildfires would be converted to climate science, but it seems many continue to vote for fossil fuel candidates and their pools of disinformation. Why doesn't direct experience of catastrophe modify beliefs?
It's a great question. You know, when I first started getting into this in about 2019, 2018, and preparing my class, Psychology of the Climate Crisis, I had this strong intuition that extreme weather was going to be a great teacher of Americans' climate opinions. And now we're in 2023, and it doesn't seem... It's a mixed picture, you know, and the literature is mixed. There's a number of reasons for that. I mean, one of them is this thing called shifting baselines. You know, psychologically, and there's actually evidence to support this in the climate case, if you experience, you know, a dramatic extreme over and over and over again, then it becomes your new normal, right? You could sort of think of it, it's called shifting baselines. You can think of it as like a group of people are fishing the ocean, and there's way fewer fish than their grandparents, but they keep fishing, and they don't know that. And then their children are fishing, you know, and there's even fewer fish, but they don't realize that. So we sort of adjust. But it is a complicated story, and it's a little hard to summarize right now. My general sense is that extreme weather can be a good teacher of climate opinions, but we need to kind of understand it better.
In your book, you assess all kinds of energy alternatives, even nuclear and geoengineering. I felt you left out a different possible driver for social change, and that would be collapse, or a series of smaller regional collapses. Maybe things have to fall apart for the new to be born. Your thoughts?
That could be. I'm not sure what that would look like. You know, the worry is that we are sort of headed to collapse if we carry on like this in a few decades, perhaps, right? But we have a limited time frame now of something like 10 years to achieve climate stabilization, which is to say, or some level of climate stabilization, which is to say if we can dramatically cut emissions in about the next 10 years, then we don't have to incur the worst outcomes. There's probably some amount of heating baked in no matter what we do. No one knows how much. But we don't have to have 2.2 or 2.7 or 3.2 Celsius. We need people to wake up now and be part of a social tipping point before we get the physical tipping point. And the worry of what you're talking about is real collapses like, for example, very substantial failure of crops, mass migration from parts of the world, things like that. By the time that stuff starts happening, it might be a bit late, right? We sort of reached a kind of physical tipping point, and then it doesn't matter so much whether we try and leave fossil fuels in the ground. So I would answer your question by saying we've got to find a way to motivate people to be part of a social mobilization before we have some seriously large-scale catastrophes.
Do you see a hope of mass social action, and how would that take place?
Yeah, I think that's the critical question. For me as a social scientist, probably the most important question, I wish more people felt like this, is really how are we going to find a way to get a bigger social mobilization in about the next 10 years, if not sooner, on climate crisis? There's many reasons why people don't band together to do things, but I think a central issue is they need to have a local theory of change. And I'm quite confident about the local theory of change myself, which says that particularly in a place like California, if one can galvanize one's local city, one's local institutions, you help trigger policy changes throughout the state that get us off the fossil fuels and get us onto a renewable transition, and that California has such an outsized influence in what happens in the wider United States that New York and other states quickly follow. And as we start getting that kind of shift, we can get national-level shifts, national-level policy, and that ultimately it's the United States, of course, that has the power to make international agreements happen. So it's having some sense in one's own mind that local action leads to national action is terribly important. And, of course, there's great precedence for that. If you think about the Nixon-era administration, a highly conniving and cynical politician brought the most far-reaching environmental legislation because up and down, town by town, city by city, people went to fight against polluting interests. And eventually that got so damaging on the corporations that they themselves clamored for federal regulation. So we have, you know, all forms of social change, five-day work week, eight-hour work day, suffragettes, civil rights movement, all of these things ended up giving us national policy, and they start very often with local action. I think we really need to foster those kinds of ideas, and we need to demonstrate and show people how to get together as activists and advocates and go to bat for their world.
Tell us about climate-friendly measures taken at your university, UC San Diego.
Yes. The university, University of California, San Diego, as well as the other nine campuses that make up the UC system, have burned fossil gas, emitting about 1 million tons of carbon dioxide. It's just mind-boggling. And that's the case in most U.S. campuses, by the way, the large ones. They have their own power plants. And so we have, you know, a small band of valiant activist students, faculty, and staff have sort of battled against the system since about 2019, and we certainly made some headway. For example, we have slayed the offset strategy. So the system assumed that it could keep on burning fossil gas and just pretend that it was going to make good by buying some carbon offsets. And we've exposed that as the thorough nonsense that it is. And now they've allocated $13 million for electrification planning, and each of the camps is sort of going through a process now of actually seeing how it would get off the gas. Now, they still are burning gas, but that is an interim victory for us in our struggle.
And aside from the book, what else are you up to these days, Adam?
So the book is connected with the teaching I do, but I'm also doing, I guess there's three components. There's my teaching, and there's the research, and then there's my activism and organizing. So on the research front, I am trying to develop a research program broadly in social science that really helps understand how to achieve a greater social mobilization. What are the psychological and sociological factors that determine whether people will join together in groups and start advocating for their world and fighting for it? So I'm trying to understand that experimentally by doing studies. And I'm also an activist and organizer, both in the University of California and also in the city of San Diego.
From the University of California, San Diego, we have been speaking with Professor Adam Aaron. His latest book is The Climate Crisis. It's from Cambridge University Press. Find lots of links to follow up in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org and check out aaronlab.org. That's A-R-O-N lab.org. Adam, thank you for helping us out this week on Radio EcoShock.
Thanks so much, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Why are we still stuck in the fossil fuel age, surrounded by toxic chemicals and bad air? When state legislators are arrested, when the Koch brothers cheat and chemical companies leak, award-winning reporter Navina Sadasivam is there. Navina is ready, with her degree in chemical engineering and a master's in environmental and science reporting. She has reported breaking news for the Texas Observer, Inside Climate News, and ProPublica. Now Sadasivam is senior staff writer at Grist, the progressive magazine, nonprofit, and website. From New York, Navina Sadasivam, a warm welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex. Thanks for having me.
Before we dive into the toxic pit, what happened to the treasured Texas Observer and what have we lost?
That's a great question. Well, I won't say that we've lost the Texas Observer just yet. I know they had a great round of funding in the last couple of weeks, and they seem to be rallying. There's so much support for that publication, and it's so critical. It's such a critical voice in Texas, so I'm glad that it's finding its way. It's in troubled waters, but I do think that I hope that it will make it out okay.
For our international listeners, what is the Texas Observer?
Yeah, the Texas Observer is a progressive magazine based out of Austin. You know, it's well into its sixth or seventh decade of publication, and it does really important investigative and feature reporting on issues in Texas. Often when other media outlets in Texas aren't covering an issue, the Texas Observer's reporters are usually there, and they're diving into the stories that need to be told but aren't being told.
So let's start with some of your stories, mainly the new way to stop people protesting destruction of the planet. Just label environmentalists terrorists and send them off to prison. Problem solved. Tell us why pipelines are good and greens are bad in Utah.
Yeah, absolutely. So Utah, really interestingly enough, is the latest state to pass some of these so-called critical infrastructure bills. As you may know, critical infrastructure is just sort of a broad term that essentially refers to any facilities that are essential to national security and public health and safety. And pipelines kind of fall under this umbrella. And what Utah did in the last few weeks is they passed legislation that essentially makes impeding or inhibiting with activities related to the construction or operation of these critical infrastructure facilities a first-degree felony. And I think, you know, it's coming out of concern that we've seen just a rash of attacks on electrical substations. And so these bills were passed essentially to give law enforcement and prosecutors additional tools. But what ends up happening is, unintentionally or intentionally, they have basically pulled in a whole lot of protest activity into the scope of the bill. So if you're out protesting a pipeline construction facility in Utah and you end up blocking a road, for instance, or you're chaining yourself to the construction equipment, you know, now you could be charged under these new laws that make inhibiting or impeding the operation of a critical infrastructure facility a first-degree felony. And in Utah, a first-degree felony is punishable by 5 years to life in prison. So these are really serious charges that you could find yourself facing. So Utah is one of the states that has passed this particular sort of law. And it's not the only one. It's the 19th state in the United States to do that. There have been a whole bunch of other states, including Texas and Louisiana and North Dakota, that have passed these sorts of laws in the last few years.
So let me get this straight. People who believe climate science, who want to protect a future for coming generations, people who speak up, they're the criminals. They're the terrorists, not the fossil fuel companies. How did that happen in America?
Yeah, there are a few reasons for it. I mean, I think in the aftermath of the Standing Rock protests in 2016, late 2016, early 2017, a lot of states and state lawmakers started looking at the protests that were happening in North Dakota and said, hey, we don't want that to ever happen in our states, right? This sort of massive protest activity is something that we want to try and avoid in our states. And so initially, the motivation for these bills seemed to be coming from the sort of large-scale protests that we saw with the Dakota Access Pipeline, but also other pipelines like the Line 5 pipeline that Enbridge has been trying to build in Minnesota. And so lawmakers were reacting to both the media attention around these protests and in some cases how violent some of these protests became because of the clashes between protesters and law enforcement. And so those first few states that passed these sorts of laws in 2017, 18, 19 were responding to the Dakota Access Pipeline protests, I think. But more recently, it does look like, at least in Utah, the motivation has kind of shifted. In the last few months in the U.S., we've seen some attacks on electrical substations where people sort of drive by and shoot at electrical substations. And in some cases, they ended up taking down parts of the grid, and people lost access to power for several hours, you know, which can be very disruptive. And so in an attempt to essentially increase penalties for that kind of behavior, at least in Utah, we saw this bill being passed. So the motivation has kind of shifted over the years, it seems like. But originally, at least, it was a result of, you know, the protests that we saw in Standing Rock.
Well, if you can't throw your critics in jail, just buy off their state legislators with buckets of secret cash. I know you weren't the lead on this story, but could you tell us a little bit about the Grist headline that said how a $60 million bribery scandal helped Ohio pass the worst energy policy in the country?
Yeah, so this is a story that has been unfolding in Ohio for the last few years. Ohio, a few years ago, passed a piece of legislation called HB1 that essentially handed a large number of subsidies, more than $1 billion in subsidies, to nuclear and coal plants in the state. It later turned out that the lead lawmaker in the Ohio House of Representatives, Speaker Larry Householder, was essentially operating a slush fund, and utilities were contributing to it, and he was drawing from the slush fund to both help himself get elected, but also help a number of other Republican conservative lawmakers in the House get elected. And, you know, in return for essentially being able to operate the slush fund and receive funds from the utilities, he helped push through HB1. You know, FBI agents since arrested Larry Householder, and there was a federal jury that essentially affirmed these allegations and found him guilty of criminal conspiracy last month. And so that's the story that we kind of covered. And you can read about it in a lot more detail at grist.org. I covered the most recent news about the federal jury, largely affirming the allegations by the FBI. But we also have a deeper dive that goes into all of the sordid details that were involved in setting up this slush fund and how it worked on our website.
And the sickest part of that story is there is a way to recall terrible legislation. Voters have an option. But the dark money boys managed to fix the Ohio referendum as well. It's almost like there was no way out.
Right. In this particular case, you know, it's quite egregious, this particular story, where you see the direct sort of relationship between lobbyists and lawmakers and the extent to which that relationship can be pushed in a way that really harms citizens in Ohio.
You know, my other takeaway from this Grist reporting is something I realized in my own research back in the 1990s. People assume that opposition to renewables, corrupt or not, comes from big oil and gas multinationals like Exxon or Shell. Sure, that has been documented in many countries, but there's a second group of dark players, the electricity utility industry owners. For example, I found several scientists who denied the climate crisis. They were paid not by big oil and gas directly, but by utility industry corporations. Have you noticed that at all?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. You see that even in the case with the protest laws, the anti-protest laws that we were talking about. A number of the groups that show up in support of that kind of legislation often tend to be utilities, too. So in Utah, for instance, Dominion Energy and a couple of other utilities in the state showed up sort of pushing lawmakers to get this legislation passed. So, yeah, they absolutely do have something to gain from those sorts of laws being passed and, in general, from pushing back against renewables because they already have so much invested in the fossil fuel infrastructure in these many states.
With your expertise, Navina, in chemistry, you and Grist report on everyday chemical pollution that seems institutionalized in America, but sometimes we win a little. Tell us about your April 6th article on new EPA rules.
Yes, absolutely. So, you know, for a long, long time, we've had a number of environmental justice advocates talk about, you know, the cumulative risks of breathing in a number of chemicals, right? So if you live in the industrial corridors of Texas or Louisiana or in parts of Ohio, you are surrounded by industry. And these chemical plants are putting out a number of chemicals, benzene, ethylene oxide, chloroprene, 1,3-butadiene, all of these different toxic carcinogenic chemicals that you are breathing in on a daily basis. Often these homes are very close to some of these facilities. And so for years, people have asked that, you know, the EPA have more stringent regulations on these more toxic chemicals, right? One of the things that has happened over the last 3 or 4 decades since the Clean Air Act was passed in the 1970s is we've done a really good job of reducing the amount of sulfur dioxide and nitrogen oxide in the air. The challenge now is to get at some of these more toxic chemicals, these volatile organics and other kind of carcinogenic chemicals that are maybe not emitted in as large amounts as sulfur dioxide, for instance, but they are, you know, extremely toxic and have real health effects. And so, you know, after years of advocacy from environmental justice groups and public health advocates, we saw the EPA this week propose a new set of regulations that target about 200 chemical plants. The vast majority of these chemical plants are in Texas and Louisiana. They require the companies to essentially monitor for 6 different really toxic chemicals, some of which I listed earlier, ethylene oxide, 1,3-butadiene, for instance, benzene. And then they also require these facilities to install all types of different equipment to reduce the amount of these emissions. So these emissions, the chemicals are supposed to be burned off, for instance, at the flares. Sometimes these flares aren't very efficient, so the standards have new efficiency requirements of these plants. They're supposed to look for leaks in different equipment and make sure that these chemicals aren't, you know, leaking out of the different facilities. These are new rules, and I think advocates, especially in Texas and Louisiana, we're celebrating the announcement of these rules because they've been a long time coming and it's something that advocates have pushed for decades.
Navina, isn't it strange so many mega chemical plants just happen to be located in places heavily populated by poor people of color and not in wealthy white enclaves? What do you think?
Right. And this, you know, has so much to do with the history of the United States. Redlining, discriminatory practices that have resulted in, you know, black and brown and poor people living in parts of the country that are closest to industrial facilities, right? So this is not an accident. There are specific regulatory policies at play here. But yes, you know, if you look at the facilities that we're talking about, some of the most toxic, the largest, most hazardous chemical plants in the nation, they are in places where wealthy folks don't want to live, right? And that makes a whole lot of sense. Of course, if you have access and if you have opportunities to live elsewhere, you wouldn't choose to stay in a place where, you know, you're surrounded by industry and breathing in toxic chemicals.
Please consider supporting Radio EcoShock. Find out more at our website, ecoshock.org. You can write me at any time. The address is radio@ecoshock.org. This is Radio EcoShock. We are plunging into the dark depths of corporate greed with award-winning investigative reporter Navina Sadasivam, senior staff writer at Grist. Tell us about the Koch brothers' company plot you and reporter Clayton Aldern unearthed in Texas just this past February.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is a story that, you know, we've been working on for almost a year, and it is a chemical plant in Texas as well. Also in one of those industrial corridors that I was just talking about. It is in Port Arthur. It is a coke-producing plant, petroleum coke, which is sort of the leftover unrefined material that comes out of, you know, crude oil production. And this is a facility that for years has been trying to evade environmental laws. And what we found was that its most recent attempt has been to try to evade an air quality monitor that was put near it. This is a plant that was built in the 1930s, and so it's already grandfathered into a number of environmental laws because it precedes the 1970s Clean Air Act. And what we found was, you know, when regulators installed an air quality monitor to kind of keep an eye on this facility just because of the amount of sulfur dioxide that it was releasing, what the facility ended up doing is it gained access to the monitor, was able to get the regulatory agency to hand over air quality data from the monitor, which it then used to figure out when it needed to change its operations so it wouldn't set the monitor off. So when the air blew in the direction of the air monitor and could pick up the emissions, the facility would then set about changing its operations so that its emissions weren't picked up as much. When the air was not flowing towards the monitor and the monitor wouldn't be able to pick up these emissions, it was presumably not changing its operations as much. And so we were able to get our hands on this internal data, 2.5 years of internal data, as well as internal emails that showed us just a sort of sophisticated system that they set up to help detect when air emissions, air quality emissions were going up and when the monitor was going to be able to pick them up versus when it wasn't. And we found that more often than not, when the air was blowing in the direction of the monitor and the monitor was more likely to pick up these emissions, the facility was turning off some of its kilns and reducing its production capacity in a way that reduced the amount of emissions that were coming out of its smokestacks. So this is a story that resulted in sort of a 6,000-word deep dive into this facility. And we spoke to a former EPA enforcement officer who looked at some of these findings and said, you know, this looks like a criminal violation of the Clean Air Act.
It always amazes me people all over America donate millions for cancer research. Millions of our loved ones are lost to cancer. It hurts. And the government spends more billions of dollars, if not trillions, for a cure. Why not try to stop these cancer cases at the source, banning carcinogenic chemicals from our lives?
That's a great question, and I think part of it is the regulatory approach that we take in the United States. For instance, in Europe, when a specific chemical is being used or emitted, it is incumbent on the industry that's using or emitting that chemical to prove that it is not carcinogenic. Whereas in the U.S., we have a regulatory system that essentially waits for the evidence to stack up to prove that something is carcinogenic before it gets banned. And so it's just a sort of a different approach.
Republicans love the fossil fuel regime, even as their states are struck time and time again with climate-driven disasters. But both parties keep subsidizing climate-killing industries. When President Biden spoke at the Glasgow Climate Summit in November 2021, he called for climate action. I wish Grist would investigate one simple thing. Why did Joe Biden recently approve drilling in the fragile Arctic? I'm talking about that Willow project in the very north of Alaska. He has to know most Democratic voters are worried about climate change. Why did he do it? Who gains? Is it possible to look into that?
That's a good question. And, you know, I know some of my coworkers have been following the Willow project really closely, and they've been covering it. And my understanding is that President Biden has claimed that, you know, for legal reasons, he's unable to deny that project because they would be taken to court, they would be sued over it. And I think the legal advice has been to him that any such decision would be overturned by the courts and would not have legal merit. So I know that's the defense that the administration has provided. But again, that's definitely something that my coworkers are looking into.
We just had a case like that in Canada, and it kind of ties into your own pipeline investigations. Lauded as a new green prime minister, Justin Trudeau got the government to buy and build a pipeline from the Alberta tar sands to the port of Vancouver. Private industry wouldn't touch it. It is wildly unpopular. Hundreds of protesters were arrested, and the construction cost has quadrupled already. You just have to ask yourself, why do even the green-sounding ones, why do they do it?
Yeah, absolutely. That's really interesting. And I can't speak to the pipeline in Canada. I haven't been following that closely.
The American Society of Magazine Editors just honored Grist with a 2023 National Magazine Award. Why do you think Grist magazine keeps publishing stories that bigger corporate media are content to ignore forever?
Well, part of the reason I think is, you know, we've been around for a really long time. We were established in the 90s, and we've been covering climate issues and environmental issues back when they were seen as sort of niche issues. You know, I remember a few years ago, you know, when I first got started, you know, I was sort of taken aside and told, hey, are you sure you want to be an environmental reporter? Because this is such a niche field to go into. And are you sure you don't want to cover politics or business or something broader, you know, if nothing for the job security of it? And I think one of the things that has evolved over the years is Grist has built up a real knowledge base on these issues. And so we're able to dive in deeper. We've been covering these issues for a really long time, and we have a specific lens through which we're looking at these stories, right? We're looking at a number of stories through the climate lens, and we're also looking at it through the solutions lens, right? So not only do we want to cover what the problems are, but we also want to highlight what potential solutions could be. And by that, I don't mean cheerleading for these solutions, but taking a very critical, skeptical view of these solutions and what they can offer us. And so I think what the ASME award sort of recognizes is just the work, the body of work that we have put out over the years and the expertise that we've built up, you know, within Grist among the reporters. So yeah, it was really exciting for us to win that award. We were nominated and we were finalists last year, but it's really, really cool and a great recognition to be able to bring home that award.
Well, poking around chemical plants in Texas and Louisiana and maybe Utah, it sounds a little risky. Many years ago, a friend of mine, like you, a trained American chemist, worked to catalog toxic materials, and she specialized in cancer-causing chemicals spread by the incineration industry. Then her house burned down, suspiciously. Local authorities declared it accidental, zero investigation. Is it still dangerous to question authority in America?
I don't think I've personally faced anything quite like that. I'm really sorry to hear that happened to your friend. I do think for the most part, you know, I'm originally from India, and I think about the kinds of repercussions that journalists in India and elsewhere around the world face. And I think of particularly the environmental activists, indigenous activists all around the world who are persecuted for speaking truth to power and asking questions and trying to hold those in power accountable. By those measures, I do think journalists here in the U.S. are protected under the First Amendment. And, you know, especially at Grist, we enjoy quite a bit of support from editors. And so I do feel that there's a lot of protection here for journalists to be able to speak up and hold people accountable. That being said, there are many threats to the journalism industry here in the U.S. as well. One thing we've seen is we've seen a lot of local media wither and sort of die away, and so there are entire news deserts in the country, right, where you don't have as much accountability reporting happening just because of the way the industry has evolved over the years. And, you know, a lot of it has been concentrated on the coast. That's one sort of big, massive threat. And then, of course, you know, one of the things that we face as investigative journalists trying to do accountability reporting is there's always the threat of lawsuits. Anytime you write about corporations or any powerful person, you face the threat of lawsuits. And, you know, for small nonprofits, it can be easy to be buried under legal costs. So that sort of threat always exists, I think.
As journalists, we've been told again and again, wrap up every story with some hope, with a promise we can still get out of this mess. Otherwise, they say, people will give up and just party till they drop. Well, that seems to be happening anyway. What do you think? Are we obligated to serve up hope for dessert?
I don't think there's an obligation to serve up dessert. To serve up hope for dessert. That's a funny way of putting it. But I do think that increasingly we're seeing polling showing that those who are reading the news are less and less engaged with it and are less likely to want to read the news and stay engaged because of what they feel is just a negativity bias, right? Journalists tend to report on the terrible things that are happening in the world, and when you only are reminded of all of the awful things happening, it's hard to hold out hope. And so that's, you know, it's one of the many reasons why we think solutions reporting is so important. And again, not to take a very Pollyanna-ish view of solutions, but to actually ask real hard, tough questions of these solutions and examine very closely whether these solutions will help us get out of the climate crisis. And so having that lens is really important, I think.
As we finish up, can you give us a peek at some of the reporting you and your team are working on coming up at GRIST?
Yeah, absolutely. So one of my colleagues and I were working on a series of stories on ethylene oxide, which is one of the chemicals that the EPA is regulating more strictly, the rules that we just talked about. So we have some stories planned around that particular chemical just because of its toxic nature and the number of people who are exposed to it all across the U.S. I have another project in the works about a number of petrochemical plants and refineries and their emissions in Texas and Louisiana. And a number of my colleagues are also hard at work, you know, working on a number of projects about the LNG industry in the U.S., about fortress conservation and indigenous activists all across the world. Yeah, so that's a little bit of what we have coming up.
From GRIST, we have been speaking with top environmental reporter Naveena Sadasivam. Find links to all the great articles we just talked about at grist.org and in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Naveena, it's been a treat to talk with you, really. Thanks for spending time with us.
Thanks for having me, Alex. I appreciate it.
That's it for this show. Check out all our past programs free at ecoshock.org. Thank you for listening, and let's meet up again next week.